right? And these eras were not necessarily the most like open-minded. So like things like sodomy and stuff like that were off, you know, what it was called at the time, were often harshly punished. But that didn't really change you. It was like you, the clergyman, did a bad thing, right? Rather than, oh, you're a homosexual, right? Like you have, like, this is now part of your identity. You know, there's this sort of fluidity, as you're kind of saying, as we enter the age of authenticity in the 19th century, it's this sort of like, oh, you choose who you're going to be. You have to figure out who you are by what you do and blah, blah, blah. But okay, that comes along with a whole bunch of collective social baggage because, you know, whatever you choose to do, whoever you choose to be, you know, why both yourself and wider society is already going to have all sorts of preconceived notions and judgments about those sorts of labels, right? Like, you know, and that's, you know, that becomes your identity for better or worse.
Yeah. And this is kind of why we're going down this, kind of this detour down queer history, right? We started talking about friendship. Now we're talking about the conceptualization of the homosexual, right? Why are we doing this? Well, in the video, there he puts forward the idea that, well, one of the reasons that friendship, particularly among men, may have began to dwindle was this identity conception, right? That the what we're seeing with these romanticized forms of friendship, these almost like kind of like platonically perfect forms of friendship where people encounter each other once and then correspond for 37 years. Well, now that there is this idea of the homosexual, people are, and this is like being, this is an idea that is being socially promulgated through medicalization. This is something that people don't want to become. This is the first time that there is an identity that you don't want to become. This is kind of the, as far as like the media theory aspect of it, and this idea of like shifting social grounds and trying to explain like such a novel shift as something that was apparently so important for us or so good for us, just like kind of evaporating out of nowhere. That's what this is attempting to do, right? It's trying to explain why friendships might have began to become something socially taboo, that what was previously seen as passionate, intimate, close was now becoming too close to one of these sort of points emerging at this new social form that is the identity.
Yeah,
right?
You know, you risk you know, having an identity that unfortunately at the time could carry a lot of you know, baggage with it or risk, and you know, to some extent still does, obviously. So there's that whole component of it as well. But then I think, as you kind of hinted at as well, with all this other social change, we also move into this era of, you know, along with this identity shift, the Industrial Revolution and various cultural revolutions, you know, we run into the world of efficiency, right? Like who you are is what you do, and you have to perform at your maximum, and you have to, you know, like to get ahead in the world, to be successful, you know. The Aristotelian view, or Montaigne, obviously, or people like that would see a successful life, I think, in many ways as having successful and good relationships, right? Like they would think, they would view those relationships as being like the most, you know, key features of living a virtuous and flourishing life, right? That is kind of sidelined by this view that no, like the, you know, the key features of living a successful life are the accumulation of wealth and capital and your, you know, economic positions and all this kind of stuff, right? So ultimately, what that also leads to is basically, you know, friendship gets kind of sidelined and we spend more and more time focused on, you know, our jobs and our careers and all that kind of stuff, right? And this is really important because, like, look, and I'm sure people are listening, they go like, well, I have friends at work and I have, you know, like I still have friends and I work all the time, whatever it is. But, you know, for Montaigne, for Cicero, for people like Aristotle, really close friendships mean a lot of time spent together or at least conversing. There's a lot of investment. It's a major component of your life, right? And if you're working all the time, then you simply don't have the time or space to have those kinds of relationships effectively.
Yeah. I think there's an interesting kind of, there's like an interesting structural point here as well. Like if we're going to be sticking with Aristotle's theory of the, you know, the friend of virtue or the friendship of character being like the primary form of friendship, right? There's this interesting kind of like, I don't know how to word it, so I'm just going to explain it. Like if you're the kind of person whose purpose in life or who makes as like their central form of life work, you know, laboring, you're going to like, okay, I'm trying to think of like how I'm going to get to where I want to get to, but I think it'll involve explaining what the virtue or friendship of virtue is. So a friendship of virtue is a friendship where you live the life that you live with someone else. So that means that if you live a certain kind of life, you're going to live that life with someone else. So like, let's say in Aristotle's typical example, let's say you want to become a serious guitar player, right? You're going to devote your life to playing the guitar. Well, the kinds of relationships that you're going to develop being serious about playing the guitar is you're going to encounter other guitarists, right? You're going to encounter other, producers. You're going to encounter music instructors. They're still going to be like your friends and stuff, your family, but you're going to cultivate deep and serious relationships around this particular activity, right? Because Aristotle says that these friendships consist of living together in a certain kind of community where you pursue a certain goal that you're serious about, right? Now, the best kind of life is one in pursuit of virtue, which is just being the best human being that you can be. Obviously, some people think that playing the guitar is very serious, and they do this too. Now, this goes back to what I was saying about work, right? Because if what you do is you devote yourself to work, then all the kinds of relationships that you're going to develop are either going to be serious in terms of work, and you're going to develop, you know, good relationships with business partners on a, maybe on an intimate level, but you shouldn't be surprised to find yourself engaged in a lot of friendships of utility with your coworkers, with various people who run your business for you, who manage your business for you, who do the bookkeeping, who manage the bookkeepers themselves and stuff like that. So certain kinds of lives are going to be conducive to certain forms of friendship, right? And so we shouldn't be surprised when people who have these rise and grind mindsets have a difficult time making friends, because they're only going to be friends in terms of, you know, the grind. And that means, you know, can this person find me a job? I'm serious yeah. about finding a job, you know.
The friendship is always going to be secondary, right? And, you know, a little personal anecdote about this. I live with roommates, and I was speaking with one of my roommates about our recent show on Aristotle's friendship, and he doesn't know that much about the topic or whatever. And I explained to him the three various kinds, as I'm sure our listeners are all familiar with at this point, in terms of, you know, as you said, utility, pleasure, or, you know, noble or virtuous friendship. And he asked me, well, what kind of friends are we? And I had to tell him, we're probably friends of utility or, you know, pleasure. We enjoy doing some of the same things. We have some of the same hobby interests or whatever. And obviously utility, we're roommates, we get along. But like, I had to explain to him, like, you know, because I think maybe he was like very mildly offended. He's like, we're not noble friends. And I'm like, I've known you for like a year. We're roommates. Like, that's not Aristotle's view of what a noble or virtuous friendship really looks like. And we hardly have the space for that anymore. And I think it's also worth saying somewhat controversially, because I know this is going to be in the back of my mind for like a lot of people, or in the back of their minds for a lot of people, what they're going to say, well, their romantic partner, right? Like their life partner or whatever is an example of that noble friendship. I think that's maybe possible, but Aristotle always points out, which I think is unfortunately relatively astute, that those sorts of friendships are generally also predicated on sexual and romantic attraction, which isn't the same thing as virtuous, you know, reciprocation, right? And so in a way, they're kind of like a specialized version of you know, kind of maybe a mix of utility and pleasure friendships. But they, just because they're a romantic partner and you do spend a lot of time with them, as most people do, that doesn't necessarily make them friends of virtue. And also, a lot of people have terrible relationships, so obviously those don't count.
Sure, yeah. I mean, yeah, that's an interesting kind of thing. That's an interesting, like, scenario to be put in. I mean, from my experience, I never really put it to anyone, like, the theory, and then had them, like, turn it around on me and ask me that. I more or less just understood. But it is interesting having that kind of experience, because I think it speaks to the sort of, like, when we, as in, like, our general culture, we have the idea of friendship. It doesn't have the same tripartite structure, right? Like, we're not used to saying, like, okay, these are the kinds of friendships, and then asking ourselves, okay, well, given that there are these kinds of friendships, which ones do I want to cultivate, right? We're not, I don't think that we're as critical in our analysis and as deliberate in our decisions as that, right? At least not most people. We don't really ask ourselves, what do we want? We more or less content ourselves with the things we have. But to the point of saying, like, well, are we friends of, you know, are we friends of nobility? Are we friendships of, you know, do we have friends of character? It's an interesting question. I'm not asking between us, but just as far as, like, reflexively bringing it up. I feel like, because, yeah, like, Aristotle does say specifically, he says very emphatically, like, we should consider ourselves lucky if we have only a handful of these kinds of friendship, right?
Yeah, and I think, you know what, this is funny enough, it'll be a sweet moment of, or perhaps either a sweet moment or perhaps a moment of heartbreak on the Canadian Philosophy Show. But I was thinking about this the other day, and I was thinking, you know, on some level, I do think that both Brandon and I are friends of nobility, because we would know each other before the show. But, you know, well, first of all, we're both super into philosophy, which I'm sure Aristotle would be stoked about.
yeah. So really noble stuff.
That's for his, speaking specifically for his criteria. But I think there's also between you and I that mutual appreciation of that kind of inner life and sense of wonder and, you know, pursuing of virtue of some kind or another, and all this kind of stuff that goes along with it that we see in each other, that I think is probably more reflective of Aristotle's noble friendship than most other friendships that I personally have out in the, like, you know, the real world, right? Like, I just think that structurally, that's probably more similar to what he was thinking in many ways. Because, you know, like, even if this show stopped, I would still want to keep, you know, engaging with you and discussing philosophy and, you know, life and ideas and reading and all that kind of stuff, right? So, I mean, I guess the alternative is that, like, the pleasure is philosophy.
Yeah. Well, this is the thing that Aristotle says about friendships of virtue, right? Is that they're both going to be pleasant and they're going to be useful, because virtuous people are very useful because they're good at what they do, and they're going to be pleasant because they make what they do pleasant and they're good to be around. No one would want to be around an unpleasant person. And since they're virtuous and they have all the right, they got the right stuff, people want to be around them, they're pleasant. So they've cultivated that way of being it, which produces it produces an interesting semblance, right? Like, if a person is useful, if a person is pleasant, they live the same kind of life that I live. Do they, it's hard to tell, right? I mean, the only real test is to see, okay, do they defy the friendship of utility and do they defy the friendship of pleasure? Have there been times where it's been, you know, a burden or been disadvantageous to be your friend? Not to air any dirty laundry or anything, but for me, I will say, like, as far as, you know, have I had to make sacrifices, like my time or something like that, or like money to go out or travel or something like that? Sure, yeah. But if it was a friendship of utility, I would have just cut it off at that point, because what do I get out of it? So that seems to check that one box. And then the friendship's a pleasure, right? So the other one will be, well, have you ever been unpleasant to be around? Well, I won't particularly say that you're unpleasant as a character, but have there been times that were like stressful or scary or whatever? As far as our relationship, there, you know, you've put me through some experiences, like getting me on the show, and it was kind of nerve-wracking, or introducing me to different people, or putting me in different situations I'd never been in, where, as in the friendship of pleasure, I would have been like, what are you doing? Like, we're just here to chill. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to do anything new with you. I just, if we're just going to be friends of pleasure, let's just like do whatever is fun. Those weren't necessarily fun, but they were rewarding. I got something out of them. So again, that's the second checkbox of, it's not just a friendship of pleasure, because if it was, well, then that would have, you know, I would have gotten out of there. So I do think that there is, through this test of time, some evidence that maybe the life that we're living has kind of given us the principle of stability that that's exemplified in the friendship of nobility. Again, it's one of those things where it's hard to tell, because the appearance is always going to manifest in something like these two, whereas the sign of virtue is something like stability and durability.
Maybe we should talk a little bit about media, BDMs, present media, and friendship, because that was the other thing we were discussing in terms of the shift and change that's been going on with what friendships mean, and was also brought up in the video that we watched in regards to this topic as well. And really, I mean, so again, we go back to Aristotle, Cicero, Montaigne. You know, these are all people who lived, technologically speaking, in relatively similar worlds. However, over the past couple centuries, there's been a lot of change. You know, if there's been a lot of stuff. You know, it's affected everything about life and society and all like this kind of stuff. And obviously, it's affected personal relationships, and obviously, it's affected friendship. Especially, like, one only needs, like, think about, you know, a friend book, Facebook, right? Like, you know, with all that, you know, all the kind of stuff that's going on there with social media. One obvious one that's brought up that kind of goes back to the time thing, which is, you know, if you're spending a lot of your personal time doing social media stuff, or you're on the computer, or you're doing whatever, well, then you're not making friends. Or, you know, a lot of these guys would probably say you're not making the space available to foster these kind of deeper relationships in all likelihood. Now, I mean, I think there's probably some counter to that, and saying that, like, well, maybe there's super close online relationships, maybe there's super close media relationships. And actually, the video that we watched mentioned a relationship between Ralph Waldo Emerson, a famous American philosopher from the 19th century, and I can't remember the Scottish guys, but they only met once, but they exchanged letters for 30 years. Right. And we're extremely close. And it was also seemingly a very noble and close relationship. However, I grant that that probably does happen. I don't think that's the standard relationship format that people have with each other through forms of present media.
I feel like there's a certain kind of divide that happens here, where, like, obviously there's differences in technology between letter correspondence and internet communications, as far as like how powerful the infrastructure is, how much information you can send. But I think also too, just as far as like accessibility, I mean, I don't know how many people were engaged in a life of correspondence back in their time, whereas now it seems like everyone has the capacity, or at least who has the capacity to acquire the technology, to get on the internet and talk to someone. Now, that's not how most people seem to use the internet. They seem to use the internet in a sort of passive way, where they're engaged in content that is delivered to them through algorithmic feeds, right? And any kind of relationship that they engage with in any particular creator seems to have what's called like a parasocial structure, right? That is one way. So the content creator produces the content, and then the content consumer engages with the content creator's content. And there is a relationship, right? The person the content creator creates a profile, which is then engaged with as far as a relationship by the consumer. They feel like they know this person, but the content creator will never know the consumer. So it's one way, it's parasocial. In the letter case between Ralph Waldo Emerson and Thomas Carlyle was the correspondent, there was sort of equal engagement, right? I'm sure that maybe two letters were sent at a time or something, but it was more or less a dialogue between one another. It didn't have the possibility of being a parasocial relationship in that regard. Now, the question is, okay, well, that seems to be the standard way of going about it, but in theory, the internet could be used like Ralph Waldo Emerson and Thomas Carlyle did. I don't doubt it. But just by virtue of the fact, not only that the internet is quite anonymous, even between, you know, parasocial relationships and whatnot, but what we call the DMs, direct messages, so these kinds of correspondence that happen on the internet, they're not liable to being shared. And I guess this is true with, say, correspondent, you know, letter correspondence. They get published sometimes, but I don't know. I don't know. Maybe like, maybe in 50 years when scholars are looking for, you know, editions to publish of philosophers, people's DMs will be published, you know, important conversations that are had, but that doesn't seem to be the way that the mass of people use it. And by extension, the impact that that technology has on society.
Yeah, well, we've talked about this before, and I think, you know, we think about, like, say, the marketplace of ideas, or, you know, the, you know, like the realm of social and political discourse, right? And, you know, how that's been kind of, you know, mediated and reconstructed and taken over by effectively social media corporations. Look, does an email function effectively like a really fast letter? Yeah, it does. So, I mean, sure, you probably could have even shown. But most people, I think most people's relationship online is through social media platforms. And those platforms, I do not think are super conducive to friendship. And there's so many reasons why. Like, well, right off the hop, like one of them is fragmentation, right? Like, there's so much disconnected, decontextualized information and people and connections that it all just kind of doesn't matter, right? Like, we've talked about this again and again. It's, you know, so rapid, overwhelming, all over the place. It's very chaotic in the sense of what the media is and what the narrative is. It's very chaotic. And it's also like, you know, if you're living through the algorithm, well, the algorithm is always going to tailor to you. So it's more like, in a weird sense, the closer relationship that you're having is actually with the algorithm, is with this sort of like AI aspect of, you know, the online world, and less with other users who are more like also being filtered through the same system.
Generally, I was talking about like the internet as just like, you know, computers connected to each other, but there is almost like media forms within the internet, these ideas of the platform and whatnot, where people are, it's not just that their relationships are mediated. I mean, language is almost even a mediation, but the constitutive theory would say otherwise. But the point is, even within these platforms themselves are mediating the internet, and the way that people are engaging with each other in social media profiles is 100% not possible to have this kind of relationship on, right? I mean, like if you go on Twitter or something and you follow someone, that is not indicative of anything about your relationship to that person. I, you know, you go on Facebook and you become that person's friend.
You know, how many of my Facebook friends are really my friends? Almost none of them. Sorry, group of Facebook friends.
I think Facebook played a very good trick when they called following an account friending someone, because then there became this possibility of asking the question, okay, well, are these people really my friends? I was never under the illusion that the reason that I friended someone on Facebook was because they were my friend. I just understood that this was Facebook's way of following someone. But then there all of a sudden became this like existential question of like, what is friendship in the Facebook era? It's the same thing. just because they call it friending someone does not mean that there is this problem of what friendship is on the internet.
You know, I was of the ages of like a teen when Facebook was super popular, and it was like important to people how many friends they had, the number of friends they had on Facebook, which is completely arbitrary and unrelated to the depth and meaningfulness of like your actual relationships.
They're not the same thing at all. They just called it friends.
And I think, unfortunately, well, that's like the most blatant one. That is, similarly speaking, whether it's Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Reddit, all these sorts of intermedia platforms, the kinds of relationships that people actually have, if they have any kind of relationship, really, with each other through these platforms, right? Unless, you know, there's obviously exceptions where it's like people that you do know close in life that you communicate with or whatever, right? But, you know, the vast majority of people, I think, other individuals or groups or whatever that people follow or interact with or watch or look at, you know, they're not really connected with them in any kind of way. And so this idea of friendship, you know, in this specific kind of media landscape is almost non-existent. It's actually not really a thing at all.
And it almost goes the other way too, right? Like the people that you really are friends with, you don't, like the core of your relationship is not mediated by these platforms, right? You might actually have like your best friend on Facebook. Your relationship isn't in terms of that, right? It's just kind of a consequence of Facebook integrating real life into the internet. That's another thing I could say too about Facebook, is Facebook is kind of the point where the internet stopped just being the internet. The internet and real life really started to bleed over in terms of like relationships and whatnot.
I've been your host, Hale, and with me, as per usual, is my noble friend, Brandon. We hope you'll join us next week for another episode.
You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
This is CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting to you from Simon Fraser University's Burnaby campus in British Columbia.
This is Bird Note. Don't be fooled by the gentle whirring sound of a hummingbird in flight. This male rufous hummingbird performs elegant and aggressive courtship displays to defend his territory, and he may travel hundreds of miles to find a mate. In the spring, rufous hummingbirds journey up the Pacific coast from Mexico to the northwestern corner of the U.S., Some go even as far north as Alaska. That's almost 1,000 miles one way for a bird measuring just under 4 inches beak to tail, making this one of the longest migrations of any bird relative to body length. But after completing one journey, the hummingbirds have to prepare for another. As fall approaches, they sip nectar and catch insects to pack on fat that will power their passage back to the tropics, this time taking the scenic route over the Rocky Mountains. But not all hummingbirds of the same species migrate at the same time. This male rufous hummingbird in the Pacific Northwest gets out of town early. He leaves the breeding grounds as soon as mid-June. Females stay behind to finish their nesting duties before heading south a week or two after the males, and their grown children trail after them in August. For Bird Note, I'm Mark Bramhill. Did you know you can listen to Bird Note in your podcast app? Subscribe to Bird Note Daily and never miss an episode.
CGSF would like to welcome you to a new series highlighting local artists and creatives alike. It's Studio 6, featuring live performances and panel discussions. Studio 6 is geared to bringing local content to you via CGSF 90.1 FM at cgsf.ca/studio6. Visit cgsf.ca/studio6 to find the latest performance or discussion. Want to contribute to Studio 6? There are lots of opportunities for brands and groups to join in. Just visit cgsf.ca/studio6 for more info.